This is the MedicCast, September 29th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the MedicCast. This is episode 137, and I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. And I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. If you are a brand new listener to the MedicCast, I want to welcome you to the show and urge you to head over to MedicCast.com, where you'll find links to all the shows on the MedicCast network. And if you click on the link for the MedicCast blog, you'll find the show notes for this and every other episode there, as well as other articles, links, and items for you to check out throughout the course of the week between the weekend episodes of the show. If you're a long-term listener, you guys know you're part of the community. You are the contributors that help provide ideas for the show, links for the show, all of the resources and support for the MedicCast, and it is certainly appreciated. This is a community effort, and I'm glad and happy to be able to offer an opportunity for all of you to get access to this show and have access to the additional resources that are available behind the scenes. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can always send an email to me here at podmedic@mac.com, and I will be happy to get back in touch with you. You can also contact me via the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. Don't forget to check out the MedicCast forums as well, available for you at forums.mediccast.com. Free to register and get set up over there. It's a great way for you to get your questions answered by other members of the MedicCast community and to share your answers for them as well. And it's a great way to share photos, video, a lot of other things all over at the MedicCast forums. There's been a lot of good discussions added to and started, so if you want to take a look at that, head over and check it out for yourself. Let's talk about some listener emails I picked up over the last week or so. I got an email from listener Rob. Rob is a longtime listener and supporter of the show, and Rob is an EMTB instructor in his region. And this coming semester, in fact, probably going on right about now, he has a student in his class that probably isn't somebody he expected. His wife, Renee, has joined the class. She saw a need in her community where they live that there were times during the middle of the day while she was home that the volunteer agency in the region couldn't raise a full crew for the ambulance for lack of a provider. And she's decided to join her husband as a student in his classroom and learn how to become an EMTB. So Renee, from all of the MedicCast community, I want to welcome you to the profession. And, you know, don't be too hard on Rob. He's going to do the best job he can. Rob, thanks again for keeping in touch and letting me know about what's going on in your region. And, you know, thanks for sharing the MedicCast with your students. It reminds me that there are a lot of instructors that listen to this show and a lot of students as well. And so if there's something in the MedicCast you want to hear, maybe you're having a little challenge with some of your students learning a certain topic, you know, one of the things I've found as an instructor is that I can explain things till I'm blue in the face, and all they need is to hear somebody else's take on it to wrap their brains around it. So, you know, if you've got something you've traditionally had difficulty getting across, maybe I can bring that up as a tip of the week or point you to an episode where we've covered it in the past. Of course, the MedicCast Extra is there as a great resource for students and instructors alike. And if you have a whole group that would like to join, there are group rates available. So we can discuss that. Just shoot me an email and let me know what we're talking about, and we'll sit down and figure out something. In any case, Rob, thanks for keeping in touch. And if the rest of you out there that are instructors or students, make sure you let me know how your semester is progressing in your studies. I also got an email in from our good friend Raphael. Raphael helps us out by getting us the tip and trick and med transcripts every week that we post over at the MedicCast Extra. What he does is provides me the text of my rambling voice. And then I go through and I add text links and some additional information, some graphics, and really turn it into a very nice enhanced PDF file. It's one of the extra tools that are available for studying and resources over at the Medicast Extra. And Raphael helps out with that. He was sent me an email right away after last week's episode on START training, talking about the fact that in his area, I think he's in the Philippines, he works with first responders, training them at the airport medical clinic, and was talking to them about triage, and was getting ready to do a lecture on triage when the START episode came out and the resources that were in the links there. And so he was just sending me an email saying, you know, is it a coincidence that I was getting ready to teach this topic and suddenly here you are talking about it? You know, Raphael, it's funny. I hear that from so many listeners where they were getting ready to have a test on a subject and it got covered in the Medicast, or they listened to the show and had a call on that topic right away the next day and were prepared for that because they listened to the show. So I don't know how it works. I guess just one of those things we have to chalk up to good luck and serendipity, perhaps. But anyway, Raphael, thanks for all you do to support the show. And I know that the rest of the listeners that get a look at your resources are happy to see them as well. Listener Steve checked in by email to ask me about clinical tips. He's getting ready to do his first round of field clinicals as an EMTB student, and he was a little anxious about it, I think. He didn't really say as much in the email, but I can imagine how I felt in that situation when I was first going out. And he's in Texas and getting ready to go out on his first rotations this past weekend and wanted to ask a question about some tips on getting those rotations done. And it kind of called to mind the fact that there's probably a lot of EMT students listening to the show that are looking for tips like that. So I'm going to give a few here, and then I'm going to see if I can get the time together to write up a bit of an article or a paper about it and put it over and post it at the Medicast so that you can refer to that as a resource for yourself or for people that you know that are going through school, and hopefully give them some ideas and help to do that. You can also click the category for Medicast Live or go to medicastlive.com. In a past episode over there in one of the live shows, we actually talked about precepting and the concept of being a good preceptee and a good preceptor. So that's a great episode. We had Peter Canning on from the MedicScribe blog and also Rick Rosati and a couple of other good resources to talk about what it takes to be a good clinical student and what it takes to be a good clinical preceptor. So that's a good resource for you as well. It's like an hour of information on just all the things that you can do to become better at your clinical rotation. My tips right here for you are two specific tips if you're in the similar situation as Steve. First of all, you know, keep an open mind, keep open ears, and keep your mouth shut. It's okay to ask questions if you have a specific question or need to learn something or don't understand something, but the rest of the time, soak it all up, and you can't do that if you're talking. So you may be one of those people that's a nervous talker, like me, and you need to kind of clamp it and keep it shut and listen to what the people around you are trying to impart. You'll get much more out of the rotation by doing that. The other thing is to make the most of your rotation by recognizing the different things that the providers do compared to what you're learning. Not because different is bad, but because different is what creates your style as an EMS provider. We all learn the way to do things by the book, and we certainly should, in most of our interventions, do things by the book. But there are always those little tricks of the trade, those little tweaks that maybe you use a different piece of equipment in the field than you did in the classroom. And some of the things you learn to do, whether it's learning to do your assessment faster by accomplishing multiple tasks at once. These things are things you pick up in the field and not in the classroom. So you can learn a lot from an experienced provider by noticing the differences and accepting that they are not necessarily a bad way of doing it or a worse way of doing it, but only a different way of doing it. And be open to accepting something different that may help you in the future in the field. In the classroom, you're always going to want to do things the way that your instructor teaches you. First of all, because that's the most confident way we have to impart information to you, is have everybody do things the same way. It makes it easier for you to learn when you work in groups, and it makes it easier when you're testing if all the students are doing the same tasks. But when you get out in the field, sometimes those little tips and tricks will help you. They aren't shortcuts that cut patient care, but they're shortcuts that save you time to focus on different aspects of patient care. And so those are my two tips for you. You know, keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, keep your mouth shut, and also be open to learning the different things that experienced providers do to help assist their patients. That's it. And Steve, I hope that you had a good time this weekend. And please get back to me and let me know how it goes. And for the rest of you students out there, I love to hear from you on how the show has helped you out, or in some way that you need a little more assistance, send me a question by email. I don't always get back to you in the next day or so, but I try to get back to you sometime in the next couple of days. I get a lot of emails, and everybody seems to be surprised when they get a direct response from me. But, you know, that's my commitment to you. As listeners to the show, I want to provide you the best possible information. Let's look at the news. My first item for the news today is looking at a recent story that I found over at WebMD.com. And this is looking at the certain COPD medicines that are out there and how they may be linked to increased risk for heart attack and stroke. These medications are medications as ALS providers, at least one of them that we use in the field quite frequently for patients that are having problems breathing because of bronchospasm, and that is Atrovent or ipratropium, one of the meds that they talk about here. And one of these problems that they're looking at is the fact that it seems to cause an increased risk for patients using these medications regularly, increasing their risk of dying from cardiac disease and stroke. And this was from a recent study that looked at patients who were using these anticholinergic inhaled medications over a period of time. These inhaled anticholinergics work because they basically cause the bronchospasm to relax, the smooth muscles that surround the bronchioles to relax, and therefore opening those small airways and air passages up again. And so this helps those patients with shortness of breath, but there seems to be some concern with the prolonged use. How does this affect us in the EMS field? Well, one of the things that we need to remember is that, first of all, we're not using this as a prolonged medication. At least in my protocols, we are administering Atrovent in company with albuterol as a first-line dose, and then we don't use it again. So this is an indicated medication for a single use in an emergency situation, and in an effort to provide a longer boost to the bronchial relaxation than the albuterol does on its own. We'll look a little bit more at Atrovent later on. I've decided this would be a good time to bring that into the med of the week, so I won't talk any more about the action pharmacology of this drug. But studies like this come up, and the problem and something we need to be aware of is that patients read these studies. And in fact, what they do is they read the headlines and they don't read much else. So when you tell them you're giving them a medication called Atrovent, they may have read that Atrovent increases their risk to die of a heart attack. You need to be aware that you explain to them, well, do you use Atrovent all the time? No. Well, this is a single dose. We're not going to be giving it to you for a long period of time, but this single dose will help you in the short term, and that it's not something that they're going to be getting long doses of, and that's what this study looked at. Again, understanding how these studies are run and work does a great job of getting you around the fact that the public sees an alarming headline and automatically assumes that they shouldn't take certain medications anymore. And believe me, I've had this problem with my father. He reads something and then stops taking his beta blockers because somebody told him the beta blockers were bad for him. You know, he's got a long cardiac history. Beta blockers are the reason he's still able to call and tell me he stopped taking beta blockers. So anyway, these things happen. Be prepared and be knowledgeable so that you can be an advocate for your patient and help them understand when they misread something. Moving right along, our next item comes from emsresponder.com and is a story that looks at the recent article about Ohio and a discussion in that state about the fact that they are not releasing full ambulance or fire department response data that they have been keeping, that they will only release the general numbers for a region. And I have to weigh in a little bit on this, but first a little bit of detail. In 2002, the state of Ohio began keeping track of response times for different types of emergencies in different areas of the state. And they released that both as statewide averages and as averages for each county, but they will not release individual fire department or ambulance service records because they keep them confidential along with patient information. And there's been a little bit of discussion. Some people want to know which fire departments are better, which fire departments respond faster. And in rural areas, especially when you have volunteer services, you know, this is often misrepresents what's going on behind the scenes. So I have to agree with the state of Ohio on this one. I think it was a good decision to make to keep this other data separate and out of the public eye. And it seems, at least for the near term, that the state's attorney for the state of Ohio has agreed that the law is correct, that keeping that information private and away from the public is acceptable under current law, along with, of course, patient names because of HIPAA privacy issues. And, you know, this is something that we all need to know a little bit about. If we want to know that our area is getting out on calls on a good response time, you know, you got a cardiac arrest, you got to get there as quickly as possible. The national push for getting those times down around 6 minutes on average is something that a lot of places are striving for. And we see that in this particular article as well, but they don't want to point out particular fire departments that are having funding issues or the local communities are not as supportive and might take that the wrong way and might use it as a way to decide not to give money to a rural volunteer department that needs those funds to stay viable. So I support this decision, and I think it's a good idea. Next up, a story looking at the National Safety Council study on drug abuse. I talked about this in a past episode, talking about pediatric drug abuse and issues in the home and how we can prevent pediatric overdoses from occurring when they get into somebody else's medications. But this further report from the study looks at the fact that deaths from accidental drug overdoses of prescription drugs have increased dramatically in many age groups, not just in children. The deaths from workplace injuries, motor vehicle crashes, have declined almost 20% in the last 15 years, but deaths in the community and at home have risen. And this is because of this issue with more prescription drugs in the home and illicit drugs being used and abused by individuals, especially those for whom the drugs were not provided for originally. In many cases, this refers back to prescription medications such as oxycodone, methadone, hydrocodone, and fentanyl. These meds cause additional problems when they are abused by individuals looking for painkillers that maybe have become addicted to them. The most rapid growth in accidental poisoning deaths during the past decade, according to this study, has been for those individuals between the ages of 45 and 65 years old. And that is, you know, a pretty significant age group. Certainly people who should know better about using prescription drugs. So we need to be focusing on this. And so if you're looking for a topic to do a talk in your community at a community group in your region, or perhaps put on a seminar for your community to come to your station and attend, this might be a topic to discuss that you can maybe get local pharmacists to come in and join you, talking about drug safety in the home, safe prescription drug practices in the home. Something that apparently is not just affecting kids, but is affecting many age groups. Finally, a story that really caught my eye this week, and I probably could have done a whole show on it, was a recent report released talking about cardiac arrest survival rates by different regions of the country. You know, if you're in risk for cardiac arrest, you should probably not live here. Or you should probably try to live here. That's what this study seemed to say, and that's what a lot of news agencies picked up on, trying to tell you that the agencies in some parts of the country were worse than other agencies. And, you know, that's just not fair to the providers in the regions that have poorer survival rates. In fact, those survival rates are affected by such a host of other variables, including and not limited to the transport times and the coverage of a given region, especially in rural areas, by your agencies. How much funding is provided for emergency medical services? How overtaxed is that emergency medical service department? These things all come into play then that affect the fact that if you don't have a unit available to transport a patient or go and actually try to get assistance to a patient that's in cardiac arrest because you're transporting other calls and there are no backup units available, that's not your fault as a provider. That's the fault of the system. And yet I think in many cases, a lot of this gets brought back down and focused on the individual provider on the street. And I just don't think that's fair. Now that said, it doesn't mean that we should not be very competent at what we do when dealing with life-threatening emergencies or life-ending emergencies like cardiac arrest. We certainly need to be competent providers of basic life support care. For those of us that are advanced life support providers, we need to have a good, strong handle on our BLS skills and then be able to meld those BLS skills in adequately with our ALS interventions. And that's the things that we can do on the street to try to increase the survival times in our regions. But some of these problems are much bigger than the individual providers. And so this study has caused some alarm, but I also think that you can also follow up and check the study out yourself and see how your region fared, perhaps see how they recommend some challenges and some changes in the rule. And this should be a wake-up call for anybody in management sectors in some of these overtaxed regions that your community is becoming aware of the quality of care provided because of financial obligations and resources, because of other problems, and take steps to make sure that you provide better care in your region. So as we move into the tip of the week, we're going to be looking at cardiac arrest survival and avoidance of cardiac arrest, really, and cardiac arrest awareness in your community. With all of these articles coming out, these news reactions to this study that released data on survival rates nationwide, it has caused the public to focus on cardiac arrest. But I believe, and I think a lot of other EMS leaders believe, that cardiac arrest is really a bad measure of a system because there are so many other variables that go into cardiac arrest survival. First of all, it has an extremely low survival rate to begin with just because of the fact the person's dead when you get there. The fact that we bring them back at all could be counted as a plus. Now, I'm not being callous about that, but you know, if you're in a rural area with a lot of distances traveled and you have not only a long time to get to your patient, if you do get a spontaneous return of circulation but have a 30-minute transport time to the hospital, well, they're not going to get to that definitive treatment that they really need to survive the whatever caused the cardiac arrest to begin with. And so there's a lot of things that affect the survivability of cardiac arrest situations. However, what I do think we should be measuring, and I've talked about this before, is we should be measuring how many of those potential cardiac arrests are avoided because of quality EMS care, immediate assessment, recognition of an MI, and treatment of that MI en route to an appropriate facility. We can stop somebody from going into cardiac arrest, and I think that that should be a better gauge of what we do. And so if we get somebody in our ambulance who's still alive and we rapidly assess them and treat them and keep them from a pending cardiac arrest, I think that's a much better gauge of the quality of your system. And that's something that you may not be, you may have a hard time convincing your local agencies, your local politicians, your local public that that's something that should be measured. But because cardiac arrest really gets a lot of attention, you know, bringing somebody back from the dead is a big deal. But they don't realize that we want to avoid that if at all possible. So I've got some resources in the show notes, both to the National Institutes of Health main page on heart disease, cardiac disease. There's like hundreds of links on this main page that send you out to sites with a lot of authority and related topics, everything from angina to different arrhythmias, cardiac arrest, all a whole host of different cardiac diseases. And I also have a link to the Mayo Clinic site on cardiovascular disease, and that page is called Cardiovascular Disease 101, Understanding Heart and Blood Vessel Conditions. And this is a great review for your anatomy and physiology and a great review for the pathophysiology of cardiovascular disease. You know, and that's a broad term in and of itself. It is covering many different diseases, from acute coronary syndromes that precipitate cardiac arrest, all the way down to the lead-in syndromes and disease process, such as coronary artery disease, heart failure, high blood pressure, stroke. All of those fall under the broad term of cardiovascular disease. It's the number one worldwide killer of men and women, including in the United States. It is a worldwide issue. Cardiovascular disease is responsible for 40% of all deaths in the U.S., more than all forms of cancer combined. Some of the different things that we need to be aware of about cardiovascular disease, some of the different aspects of it. Cardiovascular disease refers to both diseases of the heart and diseases that affect the vasculature. As people age, arteries become thickened. They become stiffer as plaque and other deposits form on the interior arterial walls as the blood moves through it. This both narrows the available space in the artery and also will cause that artery to be less responsive to signals from the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system to either dilate or constrict to assist with the maintenance of general body homeostasis. And so this leads to patients ending up having to use the heart to regulate that whole system rather than the heart working in concert with the rest of the cardiovascular system. So hardening of the arteries refers to a disease called atherosclerosis, A-T-H-E-R-O, sclerosis, and is referring to this thickening of the arterial walls. And generally what this ends up leading to is hypertension, and eventually that prolonged hypertension causes other issues, including increased risk for stroke, increased workload on the heart, which of course puts the heart at higher risk for problems itself. Different types of cardiac disease, cardiovascular disease that you're likely to see include coronary artery disease. This is when the coronary arteries, the blood supply that the heart supplies to itself, become occluded with plaque and other coatings that or may cause a decrease in blood flow or a blood clot or some kind of blockage that eventually cuts off blood flow to an entire section of the heart muscle. And if when this section becomes large enough, you can cause a severe breakdown in the conduction system of the heart as well as the coordinated squeeze of the heart muscle, causing a severe MI. And when this happens, of course, they rapidly can progress to cardiac arrest. So recognition of things like problems with unstable angina, where these people are unable to get a relief from their chest pain when they just sit down and rest for a few minutes, maybe taking one or two nitroglycerin and having a resolution of that chest pain. These unstable angina patients are seen as more severe because clearly there's a problem here that's not being resolved when they stop whatever activity brought on the chest pain. Heart attack, the layman's term for myocardial infarction. ALS providers need to review their protocols for both ST elevation MI when looked at a 12 lead or their protocols for non-STEMI ST MI. These ST elevation myocardial infarctions that are pretty easy to diagnose once you know what you're looking for. That's easy. We see ST elevation. We don't see evidence of a bundle branch block, or our protocols allow us to consult with medical control about that bundle branch block. We can go ahead and transport that patient to a cardiac care center where they can get cardiac bypass surgery if needed, or they get cardiac catheterization. However, in non-ST elevation MI, you have to rely on your overall impression, because they're going to need to go to the hospital and be evaluated with blood tests to see if there has been evidence of an MI. But a good assessment can assist the physician in perhaps diverting you to the cardiac center anyway. Presence of diaphoresis, presence of unresolved chest pain, presence of shortness of breath. If you have inline capnography, you can start evaluating their gas exchange, their pulse ox, all of these things. A good overall assessment and relaying that information to medical control can go a long way towards helping your patients that don't have EKG evidence of an MI, but seem to have all the other indications. Cardiomyopathy basically means disease of the heart muscle itself, and there are different types of cardiomyopathy that range from dilated, referring to the heart chambers that are enlarged. You can see this in cases of patients that have pulmonary hypertension, when COPD patients begin to have hardening of the arteries and passages in the lungs, that causes an increased strain on the right side of the heart trying to pump against that increased pressure, and you get an enlargement of the chamber of the right side of the heart. Also, you can see hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, referring to the thickness of the muscle. And if you don't know the cause of the cardiomyopathy, or you don't know the cause of a type of cardiomyopathy, you put idiopathic in front of it. And that's basically the way that medicine takes anything they find and says, we don't know what's causing it, so we'll call it idiopathic. And that's just because they haven't diagnosed the specific cause, but they still see the symptoms. Congenital heart disease refers to heart disease developed before birth. And these are congenital conditions, usually developmental problems, where a portion of the heart has not formed properly or has failed to resolve from fetal circulation to normal circulation. And there are septal openings in the septal wall between the two chambers of the heart that allow for fetal circulation to access the umbilical cord properly and oxygenate from the mother. But once you're born, those openings close up very quickly. If they don't close up, you can have problems with recirculation of blood inside the heart rather than getting it out to the body appropriately, or mixing of oxygenated and deoxygenated blood. Aneurysm is a bulge or a weakness in the blood vessel, either an artery or a vein. If you think about a garden hose that is old and weakened, and you start seeing a bulge in a portion of the garden hose when you put water pressure through it. It's not the same diameter all the way around, but some portion of the hose begins to balloon outward. This is a weakness in the wall of that garden hose. The same thing can happen to our arteries and our veins. And when this happens, these will usually continue to grow and get bigger over time. Problem with that, of course, is that as they get bigger and weaker, they can rupture and cause life-threatening internal bleeding. People with aneurysms need to be very aware of this, and when you hear of somebody saying that they have been diagnosed with an aneurysm, you need to ask some very careful questions about where that aneurysm is and what instructions they've received from their physician regarding it. If there's pain or injury associated with the area where that aneurysm has been diagnosed, you need to assume an internal bleed is going on and be prepared to treat a patient who might be bleeding out pretty quickly. There are valvular heart diseases relating directly to the four valves of the heart and how they close within the leaflets of the valve, as well as the fact that they can prolapse or actually be pushed backward and regurgitate blood flow because they aren't closing effectively anymore. They can also become stiffened, just like the artery walls do, and so there are ways to treat that. Pericardial diseases are diseases of the sac that encloses the heart. So when you have a an inflammation or an infection of this region or the fluid surrounding the heart, you can have a problem where the stiffness of this sac that surrounds the heart will cause this to become a closed system. And as that fluid or inflammation occurs, the heart muscle can no longer expand and beat the way it needs to, as it's encroached upon by the inflammation or the fluid. And this can be an issue as well. Finally, generally heart failure, congestive heart failure, is where the heart can't pump enough blood to get out and meet the needs of the body. And when this happens, it basically is saying that you either, if you have right-sided heart failure, you're unable to adequately push the blood out from the right side of the heart through the lungs and into the left side of the heart. And generally, the blood begins to back up into the body, causing peripheral edema or swelling. If it gets bad enough, you'll actually see it move up the body, starting in the lower extremities. And over time, you can watch its progression up into the abdominal cavity and into the lungs. Left-sided heart failure is often associated with pulmonary edema or fluid in the lungs. Easy way to remember that, left-sided heart failure, left lungs, LL. So that's the easiest way that I know of to think about that. And so heart failure can be diagnosed or looked at as either heart failure associated with the left or the right side of the heart, and the treatments may be different depending on what type of heart failure you're looking at. High blood pressure and stroke are two things that go together, not like peanut butter and chocolate, but high blood pressure often is associated as a risk factor for stroke. We talked a little bit about what causes hypertension. Some people have a higher family risk for hypertension and should be aware of that. But over time, that higher pressure flow of blood is more likely to kick loose plaque from the walls of the arteries, and that flow keeps hitting it. And as it comes around and hits it, it starts breaking things off. Obviously, the higher pressure is more likely to do that, and that higher pressure will break off clots more easily and cause stroke more easily. Arrhythmias are a whole nother topic, but there can be problems with the cardiac conduction system of the heart, such as atrial fibrillation, atrial flutter, where there's an ischemic cause, perhaps because of a blockage, has caused a key location to begin misfiring in the heart, and you can have arrhythmias as associated with it. So that's my overview of cardiac disease, kind of a review of some of the things you need to keep your eyes open and look out for. And you should look at the information linked to in the show notes. And Medicast Extra listeners, I'll be doing a whole segment coming up in the next few weeks on shock, including cardiogenic shock, for a new video series there. So if you want to check that out, keep your eyes open for it. It'll show up in the Extra podcast feed as well as in the updates on the Extra site. For the Med of the Week, I'm going to do a quick review of the medication ipratropium. We had that news item earlier about the inhaled anticholinergic medications, including Atrovent. The generic word is ipratropium. And I thought we would take a look at this drug and how we use it in the field. As I said, it's an anticholinergic, a parasympatholytic medication. It's a bronchodilator. It's site-specific and not systemic, and it dries respiratory tract secretions. It's also most effective when used in combination with beta-adrenergic bronchodilators, i.e. albuterol or similar medications. So in initial doses, at least in my protocol in Maryland, we would give this medication as a first-line dose in concert in an inhaler with albuterol. The pharmacokinetics of this medication show improved pulmonary function in 15 to 30 minutes, with peak effects occurring over the first 1 to 2 hours, and it usually lasts for about 4 to 5 hours. So you can see how this medication provides a longer-term reaction to what albuterol starts pretty immediately. And so we may not see the effects of this medication kicking in as fast as, say, our ERs will after they've patients arrived at the ER, they'll start to see the longer-term effects of Atrovent. And so it's something we need to be aware of. We're not going to likely see this medication effects, but it is happening. And one of the reasons it's given in the field by EMS crews is because it gets the medication on board to provide that effect a little bit quicker. Indications for this medication include allergic reactions and anaphylaxis, bronchial asthma, and reversible bronchospasms associated with COPD, chronic bronchitis, and emphysema. Contraindications to this medication: hypersensitivity to this medication and hypersensitivity to atropine. Atropine, think about it, atropine, Atrovent, these are related medications. Atropine is an anticholinergic drug. So if somebody has had a bad reaction to atropine, they may also have a bad reaction to Atrovent and should be aware of that. Also, use some caution in patients that maybe have a peanut allergies. These medications are sometimes formulated and have some association with peanuts in some regard from their chemical history. So again, you don't necessarily have that as a contraindication, but I am aware that that can be a possible complication. So you can ask that question and then let medical control advise you appropriately. Adverse effects that are very commonly seen in this drug include dry mouth, cough. It has an unpleasant taste, so people that are not used to using inhaled medications may have a distasteful reaction to it. Also, it can cause some temporary vision problems, including some burning sensation or pain to the eyes, dizziness, headache, nervousness. It can also cause palpitations, sweating, trembling, and chest tightness. And again, you always want to look for signs of an allergic reaction, such as rash or hives. Precautions that you need to use: you want to be careful using this drug in patients with congestive heart failure. Again, it's an anticholinergic medication, and it could cause some issues with these patients. Also, heart disease, hypertension, patients with glaucoma because of the effects on the eyes, and elderly patients in general. This medication does have some effect on the cardiac side of the symptoms and system, and we need to be aware of any patient that is at increased risk for cardiac compromise. It can worsen glaucoma if it actually gets into the eyes because of the effects of the anticholinergic effects. So you want to make sure that if the patient's using this drug, they keep their eyes closed while using the nebulizer, and that may help to prevent this. Also, it should not be used by itself. As I said earlier, its best use is used in combination with beta agonists like albuterol. So most commonly, you're going to see this as a combination drug that's administered in the inhaler along with your normal albuterol dosing. Common dosing profile for this drug is 500 micrograms in 2.5 mLs of normal saline nebulized in an aerosol device connected to 6 to 8 liters per minute of oxygen. And again, that is often most commonly seen in combination with albuterol. So you're going to have your 2.5 mLs of albuterol and your 2.5 mLs of the ipratropium or Atrovent combined into one single dose administration in the nebulizer. Again, that's 500 micrograms in 2.5 mLs, and your albuterol, if you remember, is 2.5 milligrams in 2.5 mLs. Pediatric dose, again, single administration, less than 1 year of age, it's contraindicated. Patients 1 year to 2 years of age, 250 micrograms, which is half of the dose, which would be 1.25 mLs nebulized via an aerosol device. And then for two-year-olds and up, they can take the full dose, 500 micrograms in 2.5 mLs of normal saline nebulized along with the albuterol if indicated. As always, don't forget to check your own protocols. You should never just go by what I say. I can present to you some general medical information, and if my protocols are the same as yours, obviously that's good, but you should always refer back to make sure you're using whatever your own guidelines are. That's the rules of the road for you. Hey, that's going to wrap up this week's episode, I think. Just as a reminder, head over to medicast.com/blog. By going to the blog, you'll actually get to the blog entries, see the most recent posts, and of course, you'll also be able to find all the show notes there under the podcast category. You'll want to refer back to those show notes for all of the links and resources I supply for you to follow up and keep track of what's going on with each of the articles and items that we deal with in today's episode. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, you can contact me by email by sending me an email to podmedic@mac.com. I love getting emails from the listeners, links, news items, and yes, corrections. So if I make a mistake, please let me know. We can make sure that information gets corrected and out to the listeners. If you'd like to call into the voicemail line, don't forget you can do that. Call in 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC. And we'd love to hear from you on the voicemail line, and we can share that back with the rest of the listeners, and you get to hear your own voice here on the MedicCast. Today's show will wrap up, as we always do, with some great PodSafe music. Coming back to our old friend Matthew Ebel, I haven't played any of his stuff in a few months, so we're going to play a song from our buddy Matthew, and this is his newest song. And I think we've played this once or twice before, but it's the newest of his releases, Downtown. If you like what you hear, head over to Matthew's site and let him know you heard it here on the MedicCast. And if you like Matthew's music, he's got a great new offer going on for fans of his music. You can sign up to become part of his club over there and get actual downloads of concerts, live concert recordings sent directly to you because you've signed up with him. So you can always check that out at MatthewEbel.com, and there's a link in the show notes as always. That's it for me. I will be back again next week with some more items here for the MedicCast. And in the meantime, don't forget, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and reminding all of you very carefully, Scene Safety, BSI.
look a mess, but baby, you better sell, or your daddy gonna raise hell. He gives you money, but honey, your daddy don't give a damn unless you got a Johnny.